It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin visited the U.S.-Mexico border yesterday. We'll find out what he learned and what he sees as priorities for border protection.
First, former FBI Director Robert Mueller was appointed as a special prosecutor in May 2017 to investigate Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. That investigation is continuing today.
The appointment of a special prosecutor, sometimes called an independent prosecutor or special counsel, doesn't happen often, but it often comes at critical points in the nation's history, from scandals in the Ulysses Grant administration through Watergate and Whitewater.
But despite those high-profile investigations, there's a general lack of understanding of how special prosecutors do their work and what power they have to bring charges, including against the sitting president of the United States.
Andrew Cohen is a professor of law and associate director of the William H. Rehnquist Center of the Constitutional Structures of Government at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the new book, Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, these special prosecutors happen rarely enough that it feels like they're unprecedented and we don't know how they work. But you write, there's been a long history of these guys, right?
That's right. The tradition of appointing special prosecutors goes back to the Ulysses S. Grant administration, as you mentioned a moment ago. Ulysses S. Grant appointed the very first special prosecutor in 1875. And ever since, presidents of both parties have appointed special prosecutors as a way of signaling their seriousness about getting to the bottom of allegations against their administrations.
This is a really weird role because, as you write, they're appointed under the authority of the president to investigate that president. They can be fired under the order of the same president. How does that all work?
That's right. This is the real mystery at the heart of my book, in which I try to shed some light on. The special prosecutor is a really unusual official operating in a really unusual position. On the one hand, a special prosecutor brought down President Richard Nixon, effectively forced his resignation in August of 1974. And Robert Mueller has managed to hang around, keep his job for coming up on 2 years, despite the fact that President Trump apparently wanted to get rid of him as early as June of 2017. So how can an official who seems so weak on paper instilled that kind of fear in presidents up to the point of actually forcing one of our U.S. presidents to resign. And then on top of that, the other mystery is how we as a country have entrusted this awesome responsibility of investigating the most powerful man on the planet to an official that the president can fire at any time. And the short answer to both questions is really that special prosecutors function as catalysts of democracy. They raise the visibility of allegations of presidential misconduct, and by raising the visibility of those allegations, they make it more difficult for the president to interfere with the investigation. On the other hand, special prosecutors, like presidents, are also capable of abusing their power, and that is the rationale. It may or may not be a good rationale, but that is the rationale for the ongoing power that presidents retain to get rid of special prosecutors at any time.
If we look at the laws and practice surrounding special prosecutors, we'll see the role of the president, the attorney general and Justice Department, Congress, the courts, the prosecutors themselves. You say there's a hidden figure in all this that's really the core of what happens with a special prosecutor and their success, and that's the public. Why is that?
That's right. The public, I think, is at the end of the day, the American people, that determines whether the president is above the law. At the end of the day, I really do think it is up to us. And the reason it's up to us is what I just explained. If the president wants to, if the president feels like he can get away with it, he has the power to fire a special prosecutor any time. He has to go through the attorney general first, which means that if the attorney general is reluctant to fire the special prosecutor, the president may have to fire the attorney general once or even twice before he finds someone who's willing to carry out his order. That's what President Richard Nixon had to do back in the fall of 1973 during the famed Saturday Night Massacre. First, he ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson to get rid of special prosecutor, the first Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. Richardson refused. Then Richardson's successor also refused. And finally, the third time was the charm for Nixon. But, and here is where the public comes in, when a president tries to get rid of a special prosecutor, that raises alarm bells. It makes the president look like he has something to hide. And at that point, it is up to the American people to put political pressure on the president to continue or to allow the investigation to continue, a genuinely independent and impartial investigation. And that's exactly what the American people did after the Saturday Night Massacre. The public backlash when Nixon fired Archibald Cox was swift. It was ferocious. Hundreds of thousands of calls and telegrams poured into the White House and both houses of Congress. And Nixon was quickly forced to back down. Political pressure is also the best and the most satisfying explanation for why Robert Mueller has been allowed to continue his work as long as he has, despite the president's obvious displeasure. But at the end of the day, if the president does feel like he can get away with firing a special prosecutor, it is within his formal official legal power to do it. And then at that point, it really is up to the American people to decide whether the president, whether they're willing to tolerate a president who believes himself to be above the law.
Talking to Andrew Cohen, his new book is called Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. I want to dip back to the first story of a special prosecutor, Ulysses S. Grant, appointing one, not for the scandals I had heard of, the Credit Mobilier, however they pronounced it back then, but a weird whiskey ring. Can you tell us a little bit of the story of U.S. Grant and the special prosecutor?
Sure. It's a great and relatively little-known story. The St. Louis whiskey ring was actually the biggest scandal of Ulysses S. Grant's administration, and it started as a kickback scheme in the Midwest among hundreds of federal revenue agents who were charged with collecting a federal tax on whiskey, which was at that point in time one of the major sources of federal revenue. It ended up implicating Grant's inner circle at the White House, including his much-beloved chief of staff, Orville Babcock, who had formerly served on Grant's staff in the Army during the Civil War and was a close kind of protege and confidant of the president. Once the scandal threatened to engulf Grant's administration and really reached a fever pitch, Grant concluded that he had to appoint an outside prosecutor to quell the furor and to signal that he was serious about getting to the bottom of this alleged corruption and to exposing any members of his administration who might be involved. And at that point and on that basis, he appointed the first special prosecutor in U.S. history. His name was John Henderson, with the directive to let no guilty man escape. But things didn't turn out so well for Henderson when he made an indiscreet comment implicating Grant himself in the St. Louis whiskey ring. Grant fired him, having been persuaded that the investigation was a political attack on his administration. He replaced him with another special prosecutor, but when that special prosecutor charged Orville Babcock with bribery, Grant actually testified as a character witness on Babcock's behalf, leading to his acquittal and the collapse of the investigation.
And that points to what you were talking about earlier with the role of the public. U.S. Grant got away with this. There wasn't much outcry, some, but it didn't really punish the then president. Maybe there was an assumption that, pretty much everybody in government was corrupt at that time. I don't know. But without that public support for the special prosecutor, his mission may have been doomed.
That's right. Grant faced no significant consequences, and there are a whole host of reasons for that. One is that he was basically a lame duck president at the time during the end of his second and final term. Another was that the media environment in that time, if you can believe it, was even more partisan and polarized than it is today, and Grant could rely on a really reliable Republican Party media apparatus to broadcast his message to his core supporters. And then maybe the single most important difference is that at the time, as you mentioned, Americans were sort of resigned to the idea that government was inevitably going to be corrupt in the way that the St. Louis whiskey ring illustrated that Grant's administration had become corrupt. There were no really widely shared standards of presidential conduct that could be used across partisan lines to hold the president accountable for either committing crimes himself or tolerating crimes within his administration or trying to interfere with the investigation of those crimes. The political norms and the standards for presidential misconduct and for holding presidents accountable got much stronger over the course of American history, but they are really under enormous strain at present.
We're talking to Andrew Cohen right now. He's a professor of law at the University of Arizona. His new book is called Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about special prosecutors and how they carry out their mission? And do you think that there should be more protections in place to allow them to do their work effectively? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Coming up, can a sitting president be charged with a crime? Find out what the answers are to that question coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We continue our conversation with law professor Andrew Cohen about his new book, Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the role as a special prosecutor when it comes to potential presidential misdeeds? Are you glad we have this option? Do you think they go too far, or do you think they need more authority, more protection from being fired by the president they might be investigating? And you have a question for our guest about how this all works. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew, a question that's come up a lot during the Mueller investigation is, can a sitting president be charged with a crime? I've seen different answers to it. What's your read on that?
The short answer is no. As a constitutional matter, this question is unsettled. No court, and certainly not the Supreme Court, has ever weighed in on it. And I think that there are good arguments on both sides of the constitutional question. But that's really beside the point for present purposes, because a long-established internal Justice Department policy holds that the Constitution prohibits the president from, a sitting president, from being charged with the crime. And whether the constitutional analysis of that policy or that stands behind that policy is right or wrong is one that binds Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. So it's very difficult for me to envision any scenario under which Mueller would charge President Trump with the crime so long as he remains in office.
That raises the question. The founding fathers wanted to make sure that the president wasn't, in effect, a king, that no one is above the law. So is there still room for enforcement of the law for the sitting president?
There is room for enforcement of the law. It just has to happen through a different mechanism. And the constitutional mechanism, which very clearly exists for this purpose, is impeachment, which the House of Representatives is constitutionally authorized to invoke in cases where the president has or may have committed what the Constitution calls high crimes and misdemeanors. That phrase has been the subject of much historical debate, and its exact contours are unclear. But previous presidents have been impeached for some of the same crimes for which President Trump is under investigation. Those include obstruction of justice and subornation of perjury, basically encouraging a witness to lie in a formal governmental proceeding. If, in fact, on the basis of Special Prosecutor Mueller's report, the House of Representatives comes to believe that President Trump has committed a serious crime and that the evidence supports that charge, then a constitutional mechanism does exist if the House chooses to use it. And, of course, even if the House decides to impeach the president, the Senate would still have to conduct a trial to decide whether to remove the president from office, and to do so would require a two-thirds majority of the U.S. Senate to vote to remove the president.
Now, looking at the last couple of times where impeachment was on the table for Richard Nixon before he resigned and actual impeachment, the House did impeach Bill Clinton. The Senate didn't end up convicting him, I guess would be the word. There were big changes in the protections for the federal prosecutor post after what happened with Nixon and then what happened with Clinton. Can you spell out the back and forth there?
Sure. Watergate scared people. The special prosecutors were ultimately successful in bringing serious misconduct by President Nixon to light and ultimately in driving President Nixon from office on the basis of that conduct under serious threat of impeachment. Nixon would almost certainly have been impeached and removed from office had he not resigned. But people worried that the president had too much power over special prosecutors and that Nixon had already fired one special prosecutor when Archibald Cox got too close and that he might well have fired Leon Jaworski somewhere along the way and avoided accountability for his apparently criminal wrongdoing. So after Watergate, Congress passed a law called the Ethics in Government Act of 1978, which established a much more powerful special prosecutor called an independent counsel who could not easily be removed by the president and who could seek judicial review of his removal if the president did decide to try to fire him. But that statute led to two investigations, the Iran-Contra investigation, which Republicans really hated and thought represented an abuse of prosecutorial authority and a kind of runaway special prosecutor in former federal judge Lawrence Walsh. And the Democrats, of course, thought basically the same thing about Ken Starr's investigation of Bill Clinton. The concern was that special prosecutors who could not be removed by the president were not really accountable to anybody and constituted a kind of headless fourth branch of government. And so at the end of the Clinton impeachment proceedings, when Clinton was, in fact, acquitted by the Senate, or at least the Senate failed to convict him and remove him from office, both parties were really happy to allow the independent counsel statute to die. In its place, Clinton's Justice Department, led by a 29-year-old lawyer named Neil Katyal, who's now a professor of law at Georgetown University, crafted a set of regulations which were put in place to fill the void left by the expiration of the independent counsel statute. And those regulations strike a different balance between accountability and independence, giving the president greater authority to remove the special prosecutor, but at the same time publicly committing the president to appoint a special prosecutor when an independent investigation is needed, and also committing the president not to remove that special prosecutor except for a really good reason. But at the end of the day, the accountability, if the president interferes with the special prosecutor investigation, has to come from the people. It has to be political accountability. The special prosecutor does not have the right to seek judicial review of his removal under these new regulations.
Talking to Andrew Cohen, author of the book Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. Have we played, Andrew, with the idea of having something like a special prosecutor, but appointed and hired and fired by some other branch of government, Supreme Court, Congress, something like that, so the president isn't picking his or her own inquisitor?
Under the independent counsel statute, special prosecutors were actually appointed by a special three-judge panel of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. The attorney general had to initiate or make a special request to begin an independent counsel investigation, but it was ultimately the three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals that would appoint a special prosecutor and that would provide judicial review if the special prosecutor was removed by the attorney general without cause. So that system had pros and cons. It did create a more independent special counsel. It did reduce the risk of the president picking a special counsel who would in effect rig the investigation in his favor or removing a special counsel when the special counsel got too close for the president's comfort. On the other hand, judges have their own partisan political views, just like anyone else, and are completely unaccountable for their choice of special prosecutor. And a lot of people thought that the conservative members of the three-judge panel that appointed Ken Starr had chosen an ideological partisan. Some people would even have said a partisan zealot to investigate Bill Clinton, and that there was no accountability for that decision, and that a president making that choice would make a much more balanced choice, because on the one hand, he wouldn't want to pick someone who was predetermined, who had predetermined his guilt, or would serve as a kind of partisan attack dog. But on the other hand, he would have to worry and be accountable to the people, and so he would not appoint a reliable partisan for the president's side of the case. And in fact, such a prosecutor was already investigating the Whitewater case before the independent counsel, Ken Starr, was appointed, a guy named Robert Fisk, who seemed to be doing a pretty reasonable and impartial job of that investigation. And I think most people think that Robert Mueller is a pretty highly credible nonpartisan figure, and he was appointed through the process established by the current regulations, selected by the acting attorney general at the time, Rod Rosenstein. So Biden actually has a lot of incentives not to rig the game in his favor, to appoint a genuinely credible investigator, because only the appointment of someone who is an established and nonpartisan figure with a reputation of integrity is going to signal to the public that the president is really serious about getting to the bottom of the allegations against him. The problem arises when the investigation gets too close to the president, and the president has to choose then between firing a special prosecutor or trying to scuttle his investigation behind the scenes and allowing an investigation to move forward when it might actually prove quite damaging to him. In those situations, I think there is a reasonable case to be made that the special prosecutor ought to have some greater statutory protection, although that comes with downsides too.
We'll leave it there for now. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Andrew Cohen with the University of Arizona Law School. He's been talking to us about the history of special prosecutors in the United States going back to the Ulysses S. Grant administration. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Prosecuting the President: How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law.
The partial government shutdown is on its 32nd day with no end in sight, and funding for a border wall is still a key sticking point between the president and congressional Democrats.
Congressman Glenn Grothman visited the U.S.-Mexico border yesterday. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 6th congressional district, which includes Wautoma, Fond du Lac, and Kohler. We talked with him this morning. Representative Grothman, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be on the show, as always.
Well, you're just back in the nation's capital from your visit to Arizona and the U.S.-Mexico border. Can you tell us what you saw there, what you heard there?
Well, first of all, the people we talk to in the Border Patrol, at least, definitely feel they need a wall. A lot of this wall has been completed, and we saw the wall. It was completed. Some of the wall has to be upgraded, and some of the wall is just fine. It's not long enough. But it's too easy for people to come in. The situation is completely a humanitarian crisis. Right now, the drug cartels in Mexico control everything. We heard a horrible story of somebody who was a coyote sneaking people across the border without the cartel's permission. They caught three people like that. Two of them, they skinned them alive until they died. They began to skin the third person alive. Then they let him go, say, you tell everybody else this is what happens if you don't pay the cartel to come across the border. So this idea of having a situation in which you sneak across the border is just a horrible situation. People sometimes die of dehydration. Not to mention it's not effective because a lot of people are coming through the border who would not come through the border if they had a wall. This is something I was not even aware of until a couple weeks ago. Part of that wall was built under Barack Obama's presidency. I think the funding was voted for under Bush. More of that wall was built under Bush, and a very effective wall between Tijuana and San Diego was built under President Clinton. So I am not a partisan person. You know, if a bill is good, a bill is good. It's very frustrating knowing that many of the Democrats, and I have a lot of friends over there, but many of the Democrats who voting against the wall had no problem voting for wall funding if Bush or Bill Clinton, or they didn't object to Barack Obama adding to a wall. But now that Donald Trump wants the wall, it's like, oh, my goodness, this is immoral, which is ridiculous. If it was immoral under Trump, why wasn't it immoral under Bill Clinton or George Bush?
One objection, I think, to how then-candidate Donald Trump talked about a wall was it was going to be the wall. He made the case, it sounded like, for a, you know, all the way across the border, solid structure. What you're talking about is walls here and there, fences here and there, other kinds of security. Are Democrats, do you think, just seeing this as one step in this all the way across the border wall that a lot of people say is ineffective or unaffordable?
I don't know. Well, let's deal with the affordable thing. President Trump wants almost $6 billion. Every year we spend $37, $38 billion on foreign aid. So you're talking about one-seventh of what we spend every year on foreign aid. Some people object to that, but not a lot of people do. You're talking about maybe one-twelfth or one-thirteenth of the increase in defense spending that President Trump has got. I object to that high number, but most people don't object to that. So by the standards of what the federal government is spending on other things, it's not that great. And when you consider all that's at stake, all the heroin that's coming across the border, all the people coming across the border getting free medical care, getting social services, in trouble with the law, it's a cost savings. Heritage Foundation, you could say it's not a bias group. You say it's a bias group, but they feel it's costing us over $50 billion a year, illegal immigration. So the wall is going to pay for itself. It's a cost savings measure. And secondly, even if you're just talking about the deaths in this country caused by the heroin trade and that sort of thing, it's not a huge amount of money for the federal government.
One argument,
a huge amount of money, but compared to what they spend on other things.
When it comes to drugs, it sounds like a lot of the heroin is actually coming through points of entry in vehicles, and there just isn't enough investigation, enough effort to screen those vehicles as they come in. Would money be better spent there?
They should do more on both. The Border Patrol pointed out that the reason they're not catching as much in not points of entry is because they're not catching enough people coming across the border. When you hear that a relatively small percentage of this heroin in this country is coming across in places other than the points of entry, that's because we're not catching as many people. Obviously, you know, at the points of entry, you have dogs. They should have more dogs, and they're catching people that way. But they just do a better job percentage-wise catching people coming across the points of entry as opposed to, you know, people sneaking across the border. And what we believe what's going on now, too, is as a condition for coming across the border for some of these people, the cartels are insisting that you carry some drugs with you.
Talking to Representative Glenn Grothman from Wisconsin, talking about his visit to the border with Mexico and national security. You have you've got a bill you're working on, the People's Border Wall Fund Act. This would create a fund within the Treasury Department where the public could donate money to help build border structures. Talk about that, please.
Well, right. President Trump has already compromised so much. And the areas that I was at on the wall, even if he gets this, the Border Patrol is not going to get what they want because they're going to be parts of the wall that President Trump has compromised so much already that they're not going to be able to build. We believe that there's demand out there. A lot of Americans, generous people, who feel we need a border. If President Trump doesn't get enough to fund the entire wall, that we could set up a fund and other people will contribute. I wouldn't mind contributing something towards a fund like this to make sure our southern border is secure. If we set up a fund like this, it would be eligible for tax deduction, which we think is helpful. There was a fund already set up that I don't know they crossed the I's and dotted the T's, but they apparently got over $19 million right away. And when you talk to people on the border, be it the ranchers, be it the Border Patrol, be it Customs, they say, we need a wall.
Do you think that it's worth a national emergency declaration? The president has talked about this some, where he would, in effect, go it alone, try to find pockets of money within the Defense Department budget and elsewhere to start building?
It's got to get done. I hope it's not done that way because that's kind of an in-your-face sort of thing. I wish the Democrats, I was on the floor the other day saying, I wish they'd just close their eyes and pretend that Bill Clinton or George Bush or Barack Obama was asking for this money because they'd vote for it in a heartbeat.
What do you think of the idea of swapping, sweetening the pot with some sort of permanent recognition for the DACA recipients, the people who were brought here illegally as children? The president had offered a temporary reprieve from deportation. What would you think about swapping a permanent reprieve from deportation for them?
Well, I just got back in Washington today. I've yet to see the language there. I would like to see if we're going to do other things rather than fund the wall or enhance border security, you know, let's talk. Are these people, if they have children, are they going to be eligible for birthright citizenship? Are there other preferences that immigrants sometimes get that they'll be eligible for? Those are the things I'd like to see in President Trump's language. I'd also like to meet with him or a representative of him to see exactly what's going on in his mind. Right now, President Trump desperately wants to keep the government going, and he's kind of negotiating with himself. Like I said, he's already come down from 20 or 25 billion down to under 6 billion. The first 2 years in office, he signed appropriation bills in which we funded Homeland Security and didn't get the wall. So he keeps compromising with himself and trying desperately to keep the government open. I really think it's time that some of the partisan Democrats, and last week we did have 8 Democrats break with Nancy Pelosi and vote for wall funding, but I think it's time for the partisan Democrats to step aside their partisanship, look at the rest of the bill, which quite frankly is too free spending on other things, and sign the appropriation bill and get the government open.
Finally, I just want to get your thoughts on the shutdown. Do you think there's an end in sight?
Well, we're going to be on the floor taking votes in about 4 hours. I'm going to talk to some of my colleagues on the Democrat side. The Republicans have already agreed to compromise. You know, we all voted, or almost all of us voted, for $5 billion for the wall and all these other free spending programs that, quite frankly, were more expensive than I wanted to get the wall. Hopefully, over the weekend, the Democrats have heard from their constituents. Their quotes online in which they feel a wall is okay. There's already at least a public disagreement between Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer as to whether walls work and whether walls are immoral. So I hope we get stuff done soon, and I hope that we don't include a lot in this package that is other than for just for the wall. But if it takes another month, it takes another month. To me, this is the most important issue we're dealing with, because we're dealing with the future of America. This is not how much you're going to spend over the next year. This is whether we have control of our borders for the next 20 years. And every year that goes by without that wall, that's that many more people sneaking into the country, some of them with criminal intent, other people coming here are going to live off the welfare. It's a problem. I want to point something else, too. When we talked to the Border Patrol, they told us one of their frustrations, which doesn't surprise me, is when people are coming back from Mexico, even people here maybe on tourist visas or work visas, they find evidence of a SNAP, of food stamps. So this is kind of what we expected all along, that there are people who are not citizens taking advantage of our welfare system. And I wish that's something that would get put in the bill as well.
Representative Grothman, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be on the show as always. And we are trying to get that pay on a timely basis. I wish we had a little more compassion here in Washington.
Representative Glenn Grothman represents Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District, which includes Wautoma, Fond du Lac, and Kohler. He joined us to talk about the ongoing partial government shutdown and his trip yesterday to the U.S.-Mexico border. Get ready for some white-knuckle driving on your way home as a major winter storm moves across the state.
All of Wisconsin is expected to get in on the action, with most areas getting several inches of snow by the time it's over tomorrow morning.
And those snow piles are going to stick around for a while as a blast of icy cold Arctic air moves in afterward.
Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee. Sullivan, Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tim, who stands to get the brunt of this storm?
Right now, the area that kind of runs from Madison going kind of northeastward towards Sheboygan, Port Washington, Manitowoc, kind of southwest and northeast strip of southern Wisconsin. Very confident that everybody in this area will see at least 4 inches of snowfall. There'll be some heavier bands within that where people see anywhere from 8 to 10 inches as well. So a lot of snow that's coming its way tonight.
Now, you talked about at least our area and into southern Wisconsin. What are we looking at for the rest of the state?
Yeah, so as you go further to the northwest, there's going to be a sharper cutoff once you get, northwest of like Montello, central Wisconsin. Amounts go down pretty quickly over there. So right now there's winter weather advisories for that portion of the state, the area where we've got the heavier snow from south central to east central Wisconsin and southeastern Wisconsin. We've got winter storm warnings for that area. So the further northwest you go, the less snow that we are expecting.
So it looks like the heaviest snow was going to fall somewhere in our area, correct? In the Madison area.
Yeah, the Madison area kind of looks like ground zero for where the main snow is going to be falling. It's already started to kind of develop right now, and will continue through the rest of the evening. The heaviest snow we're expecting to happen overnight, late this evening, overnight, and into tomorrow morning.
So it looks like we're going to have a couple of messy commutes, maybe on the way home from work. Everybody's driving home, and also tomorrow morning, the early morning commute. So assuming that we have to be out there, can you give us some tips to help get us safely from A to B?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things is just planning ahead to give yourself some more time to reach your destination. If you try to drive at normal Beltline speeds, going too fast, you're not going to get to where you need to go in time. And a lot of times that's what causes a lot of the accidents, is when people are driving too fast for the conditions. So we're expecting there to be pretty slippery conditions tomorrow morning. So just the number one thing you can do is if you can delay your commute, or if you can give yourself some more time to where you need to go, that really helps out the most and kind of avoids, you know, having less traffic on the roads. It also helps the snowplow operators who need to clear the roads to have a shot to be able to clear them for you to try to make it safe.
Tim Halbach is the warning coordinator meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee Sullivan, and we're talking about a major winter storm that's moving in our area from today into tomorrow morning. Tim, people always talk about having, you know, some type of an emergency kit in your vehicle. But there's always some variance between, you know, what should you have versus what you shouldn't. What are the essentials when it comes to having an emergency kit in vehicles in case something happens, like you get stuck?
Yeah, some of the things we recommend, at least having a blanket to try to cover up with. Some of the like worst case scenarios are where people will get stuck, and if the conditions are bad enough that first responders can't get to you, you might be stuck in your car for quite some time. So having a blanket on that can kind of help keep you warm as long as possible, that's a very good thing to have. If you have some water in the front part of the car with you, if you keep it in the trunk, it might freeze up. So if you can keep some spare water in the cab, where if it stays warm enough, you can drink it, that'll help as well. Those are kind of the worst-case scenarios when you get stuck. Some of our friends that live out in more rural areas, some of the things we tell people is to drive with your coats on in case you get thrown from your car in an accident or something like that. That if you don't have a coat on, that increases your chances of having hypothermia quicker than if you didn't have a jacket on.
Tim, what about gas? And the reason why I ask is because there used to be, you know, the rule of you had to have at least a certain amount of gas in your tank, especially when the weather turns bitterly cold, because you don't want your gas lines to freeze up. Does that still apply today, or have we moved to an era where technology is such where it's not necessary to have, you know, half a tank or a full tank of gas, or should you always have that in case of this type of weather?
Yeah, so that's probably more of a question for a mechanic or maybe the car dealer. My take on it would be that if you do get stranded or stuck somewhere, that the more gas that you'd have available in your car, the longer you could keep it running and keep yourself warm if you do get stuck. So that would be the angle that I would go. If you can fill up before a snowstorm's going to happen, that's always ideal. To just have more just in case something bad were to happen.
Well, until just a few days ago, we've had a pretty quiet winter, at least in southern Wisconsin. Where are we at as far as snow totals for the season?
Well, as of before we had the snow the other day, we were about a foot below what we would normally have for snowfall in a season. As I bring it up here, just to take a look at the latest numbers, Madison so far for this season's had 14.2 inches of snow, and the normal value to this point in the season would be 26.3. So we're about a foot deficit for where we should be at this time of year. And with this snowfall, we'll get closer to that, but probably still be just a little bit below. Looking beyond today, we do have a few more chances for snow going beyond this weekend, but they're more on the side of being minor snowfalls compared to what we're going to see today.
So once the snow moves out, some really cold air is supposed to move in. How bad is that going to be?
Yeah, so Thursday night is when the cold front comes through, and the temperatures that we have going into Friday morning, Friday is going to be the coldest day of the next week, and coldest day of what we've seen so far this winter. So the lowest wind chills that we have Friday morning are going to be around negative 30. Our criteria for issuing wind chill advisories is negative 20, so it looks like we'll be well past that. The threshold for wind chill warnings is negative 35, and that's a little bit harder to get at. You got to be really cold and have some very strong winds to be able to get down that low. Regardless, it's going to be extremely cold. The highest that the wind chills get on Friday is only going to be in the negative teens, so it's not going to warm up much during the day and offer any kind of relief. Going through the rest of the weekend, looks like we still keep those wind chills low in the negative 20 range or negative teens, so it looks like the cold sticks around for much of the weekend as well. So if you have friends or anybody that you know that might be out and about this weekend, keep an eye on them. A lot of the times where we've had people succumb to injuries from being out in the cold, it's been when they've gone outside with not enough clothing on. So sometimes if people are out late at night and they go out for a cigarette or something like that, sometimes they don't want to get all bundled up to do that, and then either wander or slip or something like that. So keep an eye on your friends going into this weekend if you can.
In about 30 seconds as we wrap up here, can you quickly tell us again what we can expect over the next 24 hours or so?
Yeah, snow has begun across much of the region. The heaviest snow is going to be falling tonight into tomorrow morning and should be ending by about noon or a little bit before that. Winter storm warning for most, if not all, the area around here for those heavy snowfall rates. Half inch to an inch per hour overnight tonight. Some pretty intense snowfall. So just asking people to try to stay safe and be prepared for the snow.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, no problem. Have a good day.
You too. Tim Halbach is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service Office in Milwaukee. Sullivan, we talked to him about today's storm that could drop a foot of snow on parts of Wisconsin and the bitter cold air to follow.
Two exciting NFL football games yesterday. Both went into overtime, setting up the Super Bowl. A lot of people, Darrell, you pointed this out, a lot of people talking about former Dallas Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo in the announcer's booth.
Yeah, and you know, there's some reports that CBS is trying to lock up Tony Romo for an additional few years because his contract's up next year. But, you know, many people have been raving about Romo's uncanny ability to call plays before they happen.
Right.
He's been doing that all season. He's been really great.
It's impressive because a lot of times commentators talk about, they break down the play that just happened and what happened. He keeps calling exactly what's about to happen. Since starting this job, I admire broadcast people who do sports a lot more. It's a hard job. They have to fill a lot. And, he's been really impressive. And that got us talking about our favorite sports announcers that we've encountered in our lifetimes. Who do you look back on?
I think my favorites all time when it comes to football was Pat Summerall, John Madden.
On TV,
in their heyday, I thought they were really good. Growing up in Philly, you know, the late, great Harry Callis, and who called Philly's games, and then Merrill Reese, who called Eagles games as well.
I like Wayne and Larry doing the Packers games. I grew up in Detroit with Ernie Harwell. He'd say, that foul ball was caught by a young man in Farmington Hills. And as a kid, I thought, how did he know? And as an adult, I know, he was making it up, and it was a blast. Tell us your favorite sports announcer. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.